welcome to Notes from the Western Edge, a monthly on-demand webcast featuring musicians who create on the edges of jazz, new music, electronics, and a broad expanse of sonic spaces in between. In program number 7, we'll hear from percussionist Adam Rudolph and composer Glenn Branca. Adam Rudolph has been called a percussion wizard, a world music pioneer, a master of his instruments. Long before the terms world music and world beat were applied to music that combines elements from the Western world with elements from Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and South America, Rudolph was doing exactly that. We catch up with him in his home studio in Venice, California. In 1982, John Cage associated the term fascism with Glenn Branca's music, although he reportedly later changed his mind. Symphonic musicians who followed a performance of Branca's music on a stage in the Netherlands felt compelled to denounce Branca before their own performance of Wagner. While these musicians might have been disturbed by what they heard, the vast majority of the sellout crowd at Disney Concert Hall in March 2006 most decidedly were not disturbed. Listen for yourself and make up your own mind. I hope you enjoy the show.
I think about the philosophy behind the music. I mean, I think it's important that for me to recognize that music comes from something greater than music and is about something greater than music. What I learned most from working with musicians from other parts of the world is not just the scales and the instruments and the music, but how do they look at music? And what does the music mean in the context of their cosmology? I understood that when I was in Ghana in 1977. I said the ground from which this music grows is different. The cosmology, the worldview is different. It's something else. I mean, and in some ways it's so profoundly universally human, but in other ways it's really beautifully different.
Before Adam Rudolph traveled to Ghana to study drumming, he had learned about many musics and many cultures beautifully different from each other. He had grown up in the racially diverse Hyde Park neighborhood on Chicago's South Side in the 1960s and 70s. At the time, the South Side was home not only to legendary bluesmen like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and Otis Spann, but also to the progressive avant-garde hotbed known as the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, better known as the AACM. As a teenager, Rudolph had the opportunity to hear all of these musicians perform live on a regular basis and to perform with some of the AACM members as well. And then there was the Point at 55th Street on Lake Michigan's western edge. Whenever the weather was conducive, drummers would congregate there and jam for hours and hours. Rudolph was often among them. At 16, Rudolph graduated early from the University of Chicago's high school and was headed to New York City with his hand drums when his parents suggested something more formal. He ended up in Ohio at Oberlin College, which led him to New York by a different route.
At Oberlin was great. They allowed me to design my own major, which I called ethnomusicology, which was sort of a rationale to study everything that I was interested in the first place. I spent a semester in New York studying with Alhaji Kamara, who was a great djembe drummer, and started studying tabla seriously then, the North Indian drums, and Haitian drumming, and Afro-Cuban drumming with Daniel Barahanus, and Jerry Gonzalez. So I was kind of on that scene.
While a student at Oberlin, he became part of a different scene as well.
I was going up to Detroit almost every weekend to play with the contemporary jazz quintet, Charles Moore and Ken Cox, and they've made some very important records for Blue Note. And they were so generous in the knowledge that they shared with me and like welcoming me into like some pretty high-end, challenging situations, but sort of trusting that I had something to bring to it.
In Detroit, he learned about some things other than music from Moore and others.
Charles, along with John Sinclair and Ken Cox, had started the Artist Workshop and then later the Strata Gallery and Strata Label. So the same as the way as the AACM, they were involved in, you know, musical self-determination in terms of your artistic direction, but also finding the means and the ways to work outside of the corporate spectrum to do your art was very important. So sort of political and social self-determination.
Rudolph moved to Los Angeles in 1979 to work on some musical projects with Charles Moore, who had relocated from Detroit, and he's called L.A. home ever since. Ironically, one of the things that kept him here early on was that he got so much work playing on records that were huge hits in the Japanese disco market. Since then, he's worked all over the world with a long list of musical icons from the worlds of jazz and new music. Sam Rivers, Pharoah Sanders, Don Cherry, John Hassell, Leo Wadada Smith, and Yusef Lateef. Today, 30 years later, Rudolph has taken the lessons he learned in Chicago, Detroit, New York, and Africa and applied them to his own musical life with composing, performing, recording, and presenting his own music. We've been listening to one of his musical manifestations, Adam Rudolph's Moving Pictures, with Hamid Drake on drums, Ralph Jones on flutes and other wind instruments, Rudolph on percussion and voice, and the Japanese buto dancer, Oguri. This is Ro from the album 12 Arrows on Rudolph's own label, Meta Records. Among Rudolph's many ambitious musical projects, the Los Angeles-based GO! Organic Orchestra is perhaps the most ambitious.
I realized about 5 years ago that it was time for me to contribute in another way to what was happening here. I was meeting more and more musicians who were really skilled and interested in collaborating. So I started the group, the GO! Organic Orchestra, which was and is open to musicians of various levels of experience. They have to certainly be facile on their instrument to be able to be in the group, but other than that, it's open. And so I have, over time, there's been a lot of classically, I guess we call Western classically trained musicians who are virtuosic but maybe didn't have experience as improvisers before, so this opens the door for them. Some older musicians, great artists who we know, Ralph Jones and Benny Maupin, for example, Alex Klein, and then some other younger percussionists too, who are interested in my concept, my rhythm concept, which I call cyclic verticalism, and they want to learn that and learn these compositions and this approach.
This is Morphic Resonance, recorded live in March 2003 in Venice, California at the Electric Lodge, a former Masonic hall converted into a center for the arts. According to its website, a place for travelers to rejuvenate their souls. Morphic Resonance is one of 10 sections from In the Garden, available in a 2-CD set on Rudolph's Meta Records. The most unusual aspect of GO! Organic Orchestra is not that the players sit in a semicircle facing the audience, or that classical and jazz musicians sit side by side. It's not even that Rudolph conducts the orchestra with hand signals that correspond to a list of pre-composed sections that he might cue at any time during a performance, most of which is improvised. The most unusual aspect is that Rudolph literally does not know how many musicians will show up to play on a given night, and therefore what his instrumentation will be. During this May's 10 performances at the Electric Lodge, the orchestra could have ranged in size from 12 players to 48. The night I heard them, there were 22, the same number as on this recording. That's Youssef Lateef on tenor saxophone. Rudolph has worked with Dr. Lateef since 1988, touring the world with him many times and playing on 14 of his albums, including In the Garden, which the two musicians co-composed. This is Trace Elements. An earlier collaboration between Rudolph and Lateef was The World at Peace, recorded in 1995. Rudolph's Africa 35 merges a blues-tinged melody with a very complex rhythmic cycle. I asked Rudolph about the evolution of his approach to rhythm and to drumming.
Now, for me in hand drumming, I've been dealing with hand drums and studying tablas and all kinds of African drums and influenced by drummers who worked with Miles like Ntume and Don Elias, but kind of mostly figuring it out on my own because the music that I wanted to play, there wasn't a drumming tradition for that, so I had to invent it.
Recently, he published Pure Rhythm, a book with two accompanying CDs that outlines his rhythmic concept. The book's roots go back a long way.
And I actually started thinking about this book when I went to Ghana in 1977, I realized that there were so many rhythms to learn. I mean, nobody even has any idea until you go there that, you know, every village has their own, maybe several sets of drums, and there's a whole deep tradition in relation to any one of those. And I realized you can never master any of these, even if you spend a lifetime. So, and especially if you didn't grow up there. But what can you glean from that as an artist, and how do you look at like what's the underlying universal elements? I mean, there's sort of the cosmology on the humanistic level, but there's the elements on this on the musicological level. Mathematics, everything comes down to threes and twos.
From simple threes and twos come much more complicated patterns.
My concept of rhythm is I call cyclic verticalism, which is what I teach the musicians. Cyclic verticalism has to do with something moving horizontally. So when you say 3 and 2, 3 plus 2 gives you a 5-beat cycle. So it's additive, okay? And you look at it vertically, which is polyrhythms, and 3 against 2 is the fundamental polyrhythm in the universe. The Dogon people in Mali, the cliff dwellers, who have this very ancient, profound tradition, they call the 3 energy, they call Nya, and Nya is male energy, and 2 is called Tolo, that's the female. And they say every rhythm is a marriage and interaction between a male and female energy. And this is true, I mean 3 being yang and 2 being yin, that this is true. And anywhere you go in the world, you're gonna find some combination of something happening in 3 against 2 or 3 and 2 or the roundness, what I call the roundness of in between 3 and 2. So from that, in the book, I construct, it starts from the most basic, which is the 3 against 2 or 5-beat cycles. And moving by the time you're at the end of the book, you're dealing with 108-beat cycles and 105-beat cycles that we use in our music. And they have feeling. I mean, they're not just intellectual exercises, but there's something to play on. And they lead us into the realm of form, which is the most challenging aspect of, I think, for improvisers is dealing with form, because form is where you are in space and time.
Space, time, form, philosophy, cosmology, words that demonstrate clearly Adam Rudolph's commitment to music that seeks to transcend while still being completely here, right now, in the moment. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. On a lovely Saturday afternoon in downtown Los Angeles, Glenn Branca stood on the Disney Concert Hall stage and played a very strange-looking guitar. Later, in a small courtyard just outside Disney's dressing rooms, I told Branca that his instrument looked like two guitars screwed together.
It is two guitars screwed together. It's called the harmonis guitar. I came up with the idea in 1981, and the original design was simply a guitar built on a 2x4. I wanted to have very long strings because I discovered that if you play on what you might call the wrong side of the bridge, you get a beautiful harmonic texture that is entirely different than if you play the guitar the right way. And I also realized from some of my studies of guitar string vibration that the reason I'm getting all those textures is because I'm not actually tacking or touching the string that the pickup is hearing. I'm hitting the other side of the string on the other side of the bridge, which in this case is the slide bar.
He explained further.
What's actually happening is that the string on the other side that I'm not picking is actually simply resonating sympathetically to the harmonic node on the bridge. And when I change the position of the bridge, I'm changing the length of the string, in fact, and I'm changing the position of the harmonic node, which gives me a different harmonic.
Then he added even more technical detail.
If the frequency vibration of the fundamental tone of the string is, say, 80 hertz, when it's vibrating sympathetically, it's actually vibrating at 160 or at 240 or at 320 multiples of 80. And as I change if I'm changing the position relatively quickly, then I'm getting these splashes of harmonics and these clusters of harmonics, and that's a very beautiful sound. And what happened with this strange double guitar is that a friend of mine named Rudolph Gray was doing some gigs with me on the harmonics guitar. And he suggested, why don't you build one that you can actually strap on like a guitar? So I realized that, in fact, that would be possible. And I took two cheap harmony guitars. I unscrewed the neck off of one. I cut the head off of the other. And then screwed the neck of that one onto the place where the neck of the other one was. And you get basically two guitars screwed together. And it made it possible for me to play the guitar what was essentially upside down. So, in fact, it's the same as the harmonics guitar I built with a 2x4, but it has this strange double guitar look, which everyone loves, and I, you know, might as well go with it.
Glenn Branca is one in a long line of American musical innovators that stretches back to Charles Ives at the turn of the last century and includes Henry Cowell, Harry Partch, David Tudor, John Cage, and many others. Branca's use of terms like frequency, fundamental tone, harmonic node, and sympathetic vibration place him firmly in the lineage of composers who apply the science of sound to their music. More than most other music, the sound of Branca's music depends on the room it's played in. In this case, New York City's St. Mark's Church, where Symphony No. 2, The Peak of the Sacred, was recorded in 1982. The first movement, which is 22 minutes long, begins with almost 2 minutes of sonic booms from a very large bass drum. Listen to the room. A minute later, the rest of the ensemble joins in on mallet guitars, another Branca invention. Although Branca is notorious for performing his music very, very loudly, the music we're hearing now is not loud at all. When I hear music this unusual, I want to know, how did the composer come to compose it? What was he thinking about? What were his intentions?
My music really did evolve kind of organically from a lot of experimentation that I was doing. And I mean, I was really interested in hearing what sound was about. I wanted to know, you know, from the inside. Sometimes it would be a tuning, and the tuning would imply certain ideas. I mean, for instance, I work with a tuning now, which I think of as a kind of unison tuning, where it's very easy to make a cluster, which is a difficult thing to do on a guitar because of the tuning. But in my unison tuning, it's very easy to do. And so I can get very thick, very rich, dense clusters in this particular tuning. And so I tend to use a lot of them in the pieces where I use this tuning.
In March 2006, Branca was in L.A. as part of the Minimalist Jukebox, a two-week celebration sponsored by the Los Angeles Philharmonic and the Getty Center. The festival director was composer John Adams. Music by most of the icons of the minimalist style was performed: Philip Glass, Steve Reich, Terry Riley. Branca presented his Symphony No. 13, Hallucination City, performed by an army of 100 electric guitars, basses, and one very courageous drummer, to an enthusiastic sellout crowd. At an afternoon seminar, writer R.J. Smith asked Branca a question.
Are you a minimalist? What makes you a minimalist?
I am.
Are you now? Have you ever been?
I am a minimalist. I have been a minimalist from the very beginning. The people and the composers I love have been minimalists. The moment I heard that music, it was like I had come home.
So what is a minimalist, and why does Glenn Branca consider himself one? There are many possible definitions of musical minimalism, so I offer mine as just one of many. I base my definition on Vexations, a piano piece composed in 1893 by the Frenchman Eric Satie, which I consider to be the first minimalist piece. It's a rather short piece, consisting of a very slow melodic phrase of 18 notes, which is repeated four times, twice with harmonies added. Did I say that Vexations is short? Oops! I forgot to say that Satie wrote in the margin that Vexations is to be played 840 times. A complete performance takes between 19 and 28 hours. With Vexations in mind, I define musical minimalism as music made with a minimum of materials in which change happens very slowly. By that definition, I'd say that Glenn Branca is indeed a minimalist. But it was not always so. That's Branca singing his TV song with his band Theoretical Girls live at Max's in New York City in 1977. Branca is often thought of as a bad boy rock guitarist who jumped camp to the avant-garde side of new music. Not so, Branca says.
It's really the other way around, and I just can't tell people that because they just won't believe me.
To be fair, it would be pretty easy to assume that Branca had moved from rock to new music, but in reality, before there was a Theoretical Girls, there was music for theater as well as dubious music.
When I first started writing serious music, it was for my theater group in Boston called the Bastard Theater, and we were doing very experimental, very strange stuff. But I at the same time that I was writing these theater pieces, I was also, I had a large loft where I collect instruments that I found on the street or that I got in pawn shops or that I already had. I could build electronic instruments. I could build my own instruments. I was building instruments, creating instruments, listening to instruments. And it was all acoustic, and it had nothing to do with rock. And yes, I had a guitar because I played guitar, and I could play rock guitar, and I loved rock music. But I loved a lot of other kinds of music as well. And the music that I first started writing my serious music for was all acoustic, for voices, percussion, and every other kind of acoustic instrument. And when I used guitar, I basically used it as an effects device, laying on the floor, played with mallets, as simply another texture right alongside the piano sounding board and this incredible group of other instruments. And I must have written, I don't know, 17 or 18 pieces, and that included an ensemble I had called the Dubious Music Ensemble. It was kind of a side group of the Bastard Theater. So that's really how I started out with serious music. And I mean, I was much more of a composer and thought much more like a composer right from the beginning. So I really was a composer starting a rock band, not the other way around. Can't help but say, I would say that Stephen Sondheim's Anyone Can Whistle was a very powerful influence on me. I was really into, as an actor, I was really into Broadway musicals when I was young, and my parents would go to New York during the summer and we'd see a lot of musicals, and I loved them. But when I got Stephen Sondheim's Anyone Can Whistle, I mean, right off the bat, the overture of that piece is just an absolute knockout, but the whole piece is a truly great piece of modern music, not to mention one of the best musicals of the 20th century. And that definitely had an effect on the way I think about music, and especially it was really my introduction to orchestral music at a time when people were really listening to a lot of rock, you know.
Just when you think you've got Glenn Branca pegged as a wild musical radical, he starts talking about Stephen Sondheim and Broadway musicals as major influences. As we've heard over the past 10 minutes or so, Branca's influences go far and wide, way past rock, way past classical, way past almost any kind of music I can think of. And beyond that, he's taken those influences and created some of the most daring and most original music of our time. We'll close with The World Upside Down, performed by the New York Chamber Sinfonia. In 1990, Branca composed this 7-minute score for a dance choreographed by Elisa Monte. This first movement is entitled The Temple of Venus, Part 1. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next time, we'll hear from two composers from the world of new music, both of them former Californians, Paulin Oliveros and Carl Stone. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge and Fresh Ears Media, I'm Richard Paskey. Until next time, keep listening.